Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Yay, we've got a debt deal. Oh, we've got a debt deal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses. Learn more and receive a free trial at carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, everybody, the 1st of August. Great, as always, to have you with us. Should you, by some chance, have been cut off from all forms of communication for the past 18 hours or so, let me be the first to tell you, we've got a debt deal. Or at least we think we do. Congressional leaders and the White House announced last night they've come to terms on a plan that will keep the United States current on its bills. That is, not in default. It's all over now, but the voting, about which more later. But to start us off, we sent Marketplace's David Gura off this morning with the task of explaining to us exactly how this thing might reduce the deficit by $2 trillion over the next 10 years. Here's David.
There'd be two phases to the plan. Phase one wouldn't touch the big government entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Instead, it would put limits on so-called discretionary spending. That's the money the government spends on things like roads and weapons. The CBO says this part of the plan would reduce the deficit by almost $1 trillion. But that doesn't mean that Medicare and Social Security won't be touched.
They're not dealt with immediately, but the framework that's been set up by this deal puts them on the table, no doubt.
That's Ryan McConaghy with Third Way, a centrist think tank that backs the deal. That framework he's talking about is the second phase of the plan, a special committee made up of 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans. They'd have to come up with more savings, $1.5 trillion worth, by Thanksgiving. And if they can't? The committee's failure to reach an agreement would trigger more than $1 trillion worth of cuts, divided evenly between domestic spending and defense spending. Those cuts would kick in automatically on January 1, 2013, the day the Bush-era tax cuts are set to expire. Maya McGinnis is with the New America Foundation, another centrist think tank. She says cuts to entitlement programs are inevitable.
You can make changes to those programs that are sensible, that are phased in gradually, that protect a lot of the current retirees, and that, most importantly, I think, protect the people who depend on those programs.
And McGinnis says the alternative, an indiscriminate cut, could end up hurting most Americans. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Well, there you have the nuts and the bolts and the trigger as well. Now for the process behind it, we've got Jacob Liu on the line. He runs the White House Office of Management and Budget. Mr. Liu, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Kai.
I don't mean to impugn the thousands and thousands of staff hours that have gone into the deal that is being voted on, but it does seem to me that after all of this, after the political drama that, Washington has put us through, what we're getting is $92 billion a year over 10 years. That's the deal.
With the deadline before us, the question was how could the parties come together and reach an agreement that would put us on a path towards serious deficit reduction while also extending the debt limit in time to meet the deadline tomorrow. I think the agreement that Congress is voting on will have very important consequences. It will reduce discretionary spending for both defense and domestic programs by just under $1 trillion over the next 10 years. There is also going to be a special joint committee created in Congress, which will be charged with coming up with $1.5 trillion of additional deficit reduction. If this committee fails, and by the end of the year Congress does not take action, then there's a mechanism put in place that has quite dramatic consequences with very deep cuts. One of the things about this agreement that's important is that it keeps us on a path towards dealing with deficit reduction so that we can address the long-term financial challenges we face.
Well, let me follow up then with this question, which I ask only a little bit with my tongue in my cheek. Did I miss the part of this agreement that focuses on, job creation and economic growth and, getting the economy and the recovery back on track from where it is now, which is not in a good place?
Well, Kai, when we were in substantive negotiations, one of the things that we had hoped to have in this agreement would have been an extension of a payroll tax cut, extension of unemployment insurance, things that would have, in a very significant way, extended our efforts to promote an economic recovery. We still have those battles ahead of us. They're not in this package, and they still need to happen.
I realize, Mr. Liu, that you are a professional Washington staffer, that is, and I say that in the most positive sense of the word, by which I mean you're not a politician. But is there anything you can say that will let the American people know that we're not going to be having this same conversation come the end of the year and come next year?
I think one of the very important things about this agreement is it takes the issue of the debt limit off the table for the next 18 months. And I think that what we have ahead of us is a very serious debate in this country about what kind of government we want to have and what we want our future to look like. This is not just a debate about budgets. If you look at the alternatives that the Republicans put forward in the House, it was a fundamentally different view of the role of government, whether it was voucherizing Medicare or dramatically and drastically cutting assistance to poor people. I think that we have to have that debate, and we can't have a debate that leaves taxes off the table.
Well, and last question, and then I'll let you go. How do you have that debate, that legitimate debate about the role of government in society in this country, if the Republican Party finds its line, sticks to it, and then makes the Democrats come to them, which is what happened in this debate?
We were not able to deal with the bigger issues because there is no way without balance that one can deal with the structural questions of how we should make changes in programs like Medicare. We can't do that in a world where taxes are a forbidden topic. It's just not fair to talk about having the tax burden for people who make millions of dollars not be something that can be discussed when the Medicare costs for people who retire with $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, and $50,000 are very much being discussed.
And yet here we are not discussing it.
Well, I think we set up a process where hopefully by the end of this year that joint committee will get the work done.
Jacob Liu, the director of the Office of Management and Budget at the White House. Mr. Liu, thanks so much for your time, sir.
Great to be with you, Kai.
All right, onward now to the actual economy, the one that exists outside the Washington Beltway in those weeks of debt ceiling discussions. Surely now that there's a deal, it's time to break out the champagne, toast the end of uncertainty, onward and upward and all that. Yeah, no, let's not get carried away. Investors certainly didn't today. We got fresh evidence of our economic quandary this morning, and there is some hand-wringing about whether the debt deal that we've got and the deficit cutting that comes with it is actually good for what ails us. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich has that story.
Sorry to dim the post-deal-making glow, but it's bad out there. Last week, we learned GDP is barely growing. Today, we found out a major index of U.S. manufacturing is slowing down. Here's economist Sean Incremona of Forecast.
To be frank, it was a terrible number. I mean, it really only shows that there's marginal expansion in the manufacturing industry, which, as a sector that the economy is sort of relying on to, you know, sort of pull itself out, is very disappointing.
And here's Frank Fantozzi of Planned Financial Services with some more pick-me-ups.
Slow growth in consumer spending, depressed conditions in the housing sector, dismal employment reports over the last 2 or 3 months. You still have limited access to credit for households and small business.
Whatever the merits of the debt ceiling plan, few people are touting it as a solution to the present malaise. Some economists argue federal spending and borrowing do weigh on the economy, and reining them in is an important step to restoring business confidence. Others say cutting the deficit in the midst of a wilting recovery is about the worst thing we could do. Mike Consol is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute.
The bigger problem is we really need the opposite of it. We need to expand the deficit through hiring people to do things, through a short-term target tax cut to put money in people's pockets, spending more money to rebuild this country and get the economy going.
Former Federal Reserve Governor Randy Krosner, now at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, says whether the deal is a job killer or a job creator depends on the execution. In particular, he says it could be a boon if it leads to real reform of the tax system.
This structure could be implemented in a way that will lead to pro-growth and pro-jobs tax reforms, or it potentially could be implemented in a botched way, which doesn't build any credibility.
And while the government may be tying its hands in terms of further stimulating the economy with money, Krosner says there are other critical things it can do, like advancing free trade agreements held up by the debt ceiling debate. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the relief rally was sweet while it lasted. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan began today. It's had an uneven start in Syria, where the army's been firing on protesters all weekend, heavily, in fact. In Indonesia, the world's biggest Muslim country, thoughts are far from anti-government violence, more along the lines of government-sponsored tourism. But strict Sharia law in some places in that country isn't helping at all. From Sabang Island, Indonesia, Julia Simon reports.
With turquoise waves, white sands, and a row of pretty bungalows overlooking the beach, Freddy Rousseau's small resort on Sabang is often fully booked.
A lot of people come here, and then from here they plan to go to Bali, and as soon as they arrive in Bali, they phone and say, please, can we come back? Because there's no peace and quiet.
There are fewer than 10 international-style hotels on Sabang right now, but the mayor, Munawar Zainal, wants to change that. He's trying to bring more hotels, and he hopes cruise ships. But Munawar says Sabang has some image issues as far as tourism goes, because it's part of Aceh, the only Indonesian province under Sharia or Islamic law.
If you are outside, you listen about Sharia, Islam, maybe you are thinking about Aceh is another Afghanistan, another Iran, or etc., etc. It's not like that. It's only some people, they are trying to practice their religion.
Sharia applies to Muslims, and in Sabang, it means things like modest dress, no unmarried couples hanging out in private, and no alcohol. The man who heads up the police unit that enforces Sharia is Zulfikli Agani.
In the town of Sabang, we confiscate all the alcohol to make it clear that drinking is prohibited in our religion.
But in some restaurants, that's alcohol that tourists might want to drink. Near the mosque in the town of Iboy, children play on the beach. Iboy's famous for its scuba diving, but it's hard to find a beer here. The local police tolerate alcohol at Freddy's and a few other tourist resorts, but Ismayudi Dodin, who runs a scuba diving shop, would like to see the rules relaxed across the whole island.
If Westerners come to the tourist resorts and ask for alcohol, but the restaurants don't have it, that affects tourism. Sharia law makes the tourists not want to come.
That's why the Sabang government is considering having more enclaves, special places like Freddy's, where Sharia law doesn't apply, and where tourists can feel more comfortable wearing bikinis and having a beer. After all, such enclaves are common in Muslim countries like Malaysia and the Maldives, says Mayor Munawar.
But they can attract tourism, high-class tourism, and also they can increase their economy. So they can, what we call, harmonize between Islamic Sharia and also tourism.
But back at Freddy's, British tourist Claire Emre says not having a lot of alcohol available has been nice and a sort of detox. She says she hopes Sabang can develop its tourism industry, but at the same time keep its distinct culture.
Very traditional Indonesian, you really get a feel that you're in Indonesia and it's not, you know, it's not just built for the tourists. Hopefully they won't overdevelop it so much that it loses that feel, you know, why I liked it in the first place.
She's not alone in that hope. Resort owner Freddy Rousseau says he too will do everything he can to keep the island unspoiled, special, and not Bali. In Sabang, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
Coming up, we start our summer book series, Why We Do What We Do.
Think about it. Most of us spend over half of our waking hours at work. That makes it a powerful lens for examining who we are and where we're going.
But first, let's us do the numbers. Hey, what do you know? It really is the economy. Yeah, we got a debt deal, but back in the real world, weak manufacturing numbers push markets lower today. Dow Industrial slid 10 points, about a 10%, ended at 12,132. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ ditched 11 points. That's 0.4% on that index. Finished at 2744. The S&P 500 dropped 5 points, also 0.4%. Closed at 1286. Investors tore down shares of International Paper by almost 0.5%, but Hewlett-Packard rebounded from an early loss to close up a fraction or so. There were concerns about cuts to the Pentagon in that debt deal. Shares of defense contractor KBR unloaded 1.5% today. Boeing sputtered 0.2%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell yet again to 2.75%. That's really low, y'all. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, online automatic backup designed for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically backs up files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other problem, files can easily be recovered. More information and a free trial by visiting Carbonite.com using the code Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for June. Is anyone spending on cars? Automakers are scheduled to release sales numbers for July. And get to know your neighbors and your sheriff. It's National Night Out, an annual event to encourage participation in local anti-crime programs. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This probably isn't what you want to hear during a summer that's brought the kind of heat most of the country's had this year, but all that AC we've been using, not good at all for the planet. 45% of the electricity we use in this country for, say, air conditioning, comes from burning coal. And when you burn coal, you get things like mercury in the atmosphere as a result, and carbon dioxide, greenhouse gas enemy number one. But power from coal does have two things going for it. It's cheap, and it's abundant, which is why, forget foreign oil, we've got a coal addiction in this country. Today and tomorrow, we're going to be looking at coal, starting with how we got hooked on it in the first place. Catherine Winter from American Radio Works reports.
Digging up coal has changed the shape of America. The first railroads that sliced through the continent and sped up Americans' lives were built to carry coal. Miners have blown the tops off of mountains and stripped off millions of acres of land for surface mines. America sits on a vast and valuable coal stockpile. But when European settlers began arriving here, they weren't interested. When they wrote home about America's fuel riches, they meant its enormous forests. In 1630, Puritan minister Francis Higginson boasted that there was no better wood in the world.
Though it be somewhat cold here in the winter, yet we have plenty of fire to warm us. Nay, all Europe is not able to afford to make so great fires as New England.
People liked burning wood because it wasn't as dirty and stinky as the coal people burned back in England. And America's coal was hard to get at, west of the Appalachian Mountains. When people here began building factories, after the American Revolution, they used water for power, not coal.
So it's not Boston, but Lowell in Massachusetts, which is the first big American industrial town.
Historian David Nye studies American energy consumption. Nye says instead of the smoky, crowded, industrial cities of England, America had small factory towns scattered along rivers, towns like Lowell.
It was a tourist attraction, and Andrew Jackson, then President of the United States, made a special detour to see the Lowell factories when he made a tour of New England, because that was a significant sight, something he had never seen, a whole town of factories.
But settlers who crossed the mountains discovered the coal. Near the fort at what later became Pittsburgh, coal came right to the surface. You could walk up and kick it. Burning coal for power was easier than damming a river. By the early 1800s, people had begun using coal to make glass and run blacksmith shops and mold metal. Coal meant people could have comforts they hadn't had before, but it also meant smoke.
And when you look at early images of Pittsburgh, there's a very conscious attempt by the person, the artist, to let the smoke be very obvious.
Joel Tarr teaches history and policy at Carnegie Mellon University.
It was a sign of progress. It was a sign of growth. It was something to be proud of.
Old paintings and drawings show smoke pouring from chimneys and steamboats and trains. Visitors to Pittsburgh said you could smell the city from miles away. Residents had to sweep soot off their porches and wash it out of their clothes. But they didn't know coal smoke was causing lung disease.
In the 19th century, there were some physicians saying that smoke was actually beneficial for your health. It could help clear your system up, breathing in coal smoke.
Coal use rose through the 1800s, Most of it went for heat and industry. But as the century drew to a close, entrepreneurs started burning coal to make electricity. Historian David Nye says the new utilities sent salesmen door to door.
When it was dark in the winter, they'd try to sell you a light. When it was hot in the summer, they'd try to sell you fans.
The idea wasn't to sell fans, it was to sell electricity. People were delighted with the convenience of new electric irons and electric lights. The electricity came from coal, burned right in the cities. That added to the smoke from factories and the smoke from coal people shoveled into home furnaces. Joel Tarr.
Pittsburgh, for instance, was known as a two-shirt-a-day town. You had to take an extra white shirt downtown because by noon your shirt collar was smudged up.
In Pittsburgh and in other industrial towns, smoke ate into buildings and killed trees. On bad days, the streetlights had to be on at midday.
We grew up, and we thought that smog and fog were a way of life. So oftentimes we walked to school and really couldn't see where we were going.
Charles Stacy grew up in Denora, Pennsylvania, where there was a steel plant and a zinc works. In October of 1948, there was a temperature inversion. Toxic smoke filled the valley. 20 people died. Thousands more got sick. It made international news.
A death-bringing fog settles over Pennsylvania's bustling industrial town of Denora. Residents have difficulty in breathing the murky air as the town is plunged into darkness. Oxygen tents care for sufferers in the local emergency hospital.
After several days, the weather changed and the cloud lifted, but the incident made a deep impression on the country. Now that people knew how toxic the smoke could be, they wanted it cleaned up. Finally, in 1963, the first federal Clean Air Act passed. The act forced utilities to clean some of the toxins from coal smoke, but at the same time, Americans ramped up their use of electricity.
You can have your cake and you can eat it. Make life sweet, it's hard to beat it. What a thrill to be so free when you live better electrically.
Utility campaigns in the 1950s and 60s urged Americans to buy electric appliances, and we did. We still do. The latest new gadget turns from a novelty into a necessity, and we keep using more electricity. So we burn more coal. A graph of America's coal use since the 1960s shows a steadily rising line, and utilities are still building new coal plants today. I'm Catherine Winter for Marketplace.
That's from a one-hour documentary that Catherine and American Radio Works produced on coal use in this country. You can find it in its full length at AmericanRadioWorks.org. As we were reminded this morning with Wall Street's short-lived debt deal relief rally, all is not well with the American economy. No need really to count the ways, but jobs is number one on that list. And we'll get the latest unemployment report Friday morning. The July numbers are going to be out. But right now, something a little bit different about jobs and how we think of them. For our summer book series this year, we've asked people from different professions to discuss writing and work, books that have influenced careers or helped people answer this question. So, what do you want to be when you grow up? Today, author Daniel Pink.
One afternoon in 1974, I spotted a book my parents had brought home from our local library in Central Ohio. It was by a guy with a weird name, Studs Terkel. The title was in boxy black and red letters, Working: People Talk About What They Do All Day and How They Feel About What They Do. I was 10 years old at the time and cared about sports and not much else. So I read Terkel's interview with the baseball player, a relief pitcher for the San Francisco Giants. To my surprise, I ended up staying for the cab driver, the bank teller, the grave digger, and yes, I'll admit it, the prostitute. Hearing real grown-ups talk about what they did for a living was a revelation. It was far more exotic and exciting than reading about phantom toll booths or some old lady's mixed-up files. I even asked my dad if I could see his office. In many ways, that book began my obsession with work. Trying to understand what work is, how it's organized, and when it can become, as Terkel put it, a source of daily meaning as well as daily bread. Work, I've realized, is an amazing topic to explore. Psychology, economics, anthropology, and a few scoops of biology blended into a ginormous, fascinating smoothie. Think about it. Most of us spend over half of our waking hours at work. That makes it a powerful lens for examining who we are and where we're going. I left Ohio long ago and now live and work in Washington, D.C. This city can be an uptight place. It has a strange social convention. Apparently, you're not supposed to ask people you've just met about their jobs. We're dying to know, of course, but inquiring is considered intrusive, immodest, a bit uncouth. I don't care. Whenever I meet someone new, I always ask the same question, the question Studs Terkel planted in my young mind. So, what do you do?
Daniel Pink writes books. His latest is called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. You can check out our summer book series on our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. And feel free to write us while you're there. Click on the link that says Contact.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Just because there's not enough news and information in the world, we take you to Times Square, New York City, for our final note today. There are some new lights on Broadway, if you will. Nothing to do with the new musical. A 60-foot-high electronic billboard is running ads for the Xinhua News Agency. The Chinese state-run news service is trying to build its brand and build an American audience. So we went out and we asked some passersby what they thought.
Wow, it seems like some travel agency or some human rights in China.
It also raises a question for me as to what the news that's going to be on there, is it what they want you to hear as opposed to what's actually happening?
It's so interesting the Chinese news agency has rented space in Times Square. It shows how the world is changing.
Adding irony to irony, I suppose you could say, the Xinhua ads replace a long-running spot for the British bank HSBC. It announced 30,000 worldwide layoffs today. And with that, that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow slid 10 points, about a tenth of 1%, ended things at 12,132. The NASDAQ off 11 points, the S&P 500 down 5 points, 0.4% for both of those. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here.
The shame around money is greater than the shame about sex.
I just don't know what to say. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for it tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.